It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Realpolitik. I am your host, Firas Modad. I am joined today by Graham Connolly. He's a barrister in Sydney who's advised the Australian government on national security and law issues. He served in the Naval Intelligence at the Royal Australian Navy, South China Sea, the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea, so he knows the topics that we want to talk about rather well. He regularly writes about national security and governance, and he gives always a realistic conservative perspective, I'd argue. You should check out his blog at Strategy Council and his Twitter at Gray Connolly. Just to clarify, these are his own views that he'll be sharing with us tonight, not those of the Australian government. Gray, how are you?
Very well. Thank you for inviting me on, and very much looking forward to the discussion.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Maybe we can, well, the issue of the hour is the Middle East and what's going on with Iran. We're recording this on the 20th of June. There'll be a lag before it comes out. But maybe we can start with your perspective on Russia and Israel, because you're in an unusual position where you have been quite understanding of the position of both the Russians and the Israelis. Things online tend to be either or here. The Russia supporters end up being Hamas supporters, and the Ukraine supporters end up being Israel supporters. So I wanted to understand the worldview and mindset that lets you be a little bit more distinctive than the rest, please.
Well, okay. I come to the debate slightly differently from everyone else, and I think perhaps this is because I was always a history major and things like that. If you look at both Russia, Israel, look at Iran, you look at a lot of these countries, Turkey as well. You're dealing with basically an historical civilizational power. In other words, you're dealing with countries that have long memories and they have a long continuous popular memory and an understanding of how their world exists and how it should be. And I think one of the reasons why I am slightly unique, apart from my natural tendency just not to join herds, I have a great dislike of mobs and people just following in with tribes and tribalism. I find it self-defeating and I find it almost undignified. I think for mature adults to just follow herds. But if I could put it in simple terms, both the Russians and the Israelis, and I think this is a problem that people who are against Israel don't really understand. Israel is the sort of the Jewish national home, but there are also large numbers of Christians and Arab Israelis who have fully bought into the Israeli project and who consider themselves every bit as Israeli as anyone else in the nation. And similarly, Russia in its own way is actually much more than just some sort of Slavic Orthodox country. I think one of the things that's been missed in the last 20 years is how much, for instance, Putin in his case has done to try and reach out, particularly to Muslims and other minorities in Russia itself. And so you have in these sort of civilizational nation states, you also have a sort of multi-ethnic and a multi-faith perspective. And I think that means, therefore, the one thing the nation state has to do in both those countries to hold those polities together is provide security and order. And it does that by two ways. Obviously, there's the kinetic side, there's the large armed forces, there's the security state, but there's also that national idea that sort of, and everyone belongs to that. The one thing that both those sort of nation states that are civilizations cannot accept, and this would, I think, would apply equally to the Turks, certainly would apply to China, certainly I think would apply to Iran, regardless who runs it, is the idea that you cannot have the nation state challenged by an external actor and made to feel threatened. And the simple analogy I use with people is, and I've heard other people use this, so this is not my idea, but I like it. It's that if you live next door to a bear and I tell you not to poke the bear, particularly a mother bear, it's not because I'm pro-bear. It's because I think nothing good is going to happen here. And in their own ways, what the West has handled Russia and the way that particularly the Palestinians have handled Israel is a way of poking a bear, a much bigger animal that will simply devour them. And so insofar as I see the logical, and so to go back, I see the history going backwards of how these sort of civilizational states form themselves. And I see the present and how they work. And I can see the obvious consequences of stupid things. Then I am kind of understanding of them for the simple reason that as an Australian, if what happened to Israel happened to Australia, I would want to reserve the right for Australia to do whatever it needed to do to recover its hostages and to engaged in a responsible but nonetheless devastating use of armed force to make sure it never happened again. So I guess what I'm trying to say to you is I have a much more a conservative realist view of the world. I don't have it like in a kind of mean way or an economically driven way. I just have a conservative realist way that comes out of just the human nature and the nature of a nation is really a large family. And it becomes even more complex when you have that multi-faith, multi-ethnic polity, because the state actually has to do much more to hold it all together, because you don't have the benefits of necessarily homogeneity. You have to do more to hold it together. And so the state has to energetically do that. So I think that's just one thing that was missed in both the Russian and the Israeli cases, is these were both sort of civilizational powers that when confronted had to, vindicate their rights. And I've never really understood how anyone thought the Israelis would endure what they did, and that they would not respond in a devastating manner. I mean, the Hamas had to know what was going to happen to them. Similarly, the idea that you would expand NATO and then start dangling Ukrainian membership of NATO and not expect the Russians to react was just insane. And I don't think it would matter who ran Russia. Mm. I mean, I've said this over and over again. I've said this on Twitter, I've said this over. In the Russian political sphere, Putin is looked upon as a legalist, something of an obscurantist, someone who many Russians think is not strong enough in defending Russian interests and Russian rights. He's far too mild. A friend of mine who said once, who's from a Slavic background, he says that Putin is probably the best leader that the West is going to get from Russia. It's just downhill after him, probably. And if you thought out any of the czars, they would have exactly the same policy.
Yes. It was very obvious to me after 7 October that the Israeli retaliation was going to be absolutely devastating. I think now, though, the stated policy of the Israelis is to get the Gazans out of Gaza permanently, with the exploration of which countries could they go to and how to kick them out. And I think with the strikes on Iran now, the possibility of breaching the border with Egypt and forcing the Palestinians into Egypt, whether they like it or not, is more of a realistic possibility. I think that what people have a problem with is that the view that the West would tolerate something like that is no longer held. That the West would tolerate the mass expulsion of a population is just not accepted in the West anymore. And that the cost of it in terms of relations with the Muslim world are quite severe, and that in the West, the response to various terrorist attacks was never that. So I remember after 9/11, friends of mine calling me from the United States and saying, we're leaving the US because they're going to be running around massacring Muslims. The expectation was of some kind of collective punishment, and that never materialized, and any attempt to do something of the sort was instantly condemned. So the objection tends to be that well, given all of the terrorist attacks that have happened in the West, there was never this kind of reaction to expel all Muslims from the West en masse. So I think that that's the complicating factor in Israel's case, or that's the additional dimension in Israel's case, that the destruction of Hamas is one thing, and God knows it's necessary to sort of eliminate these kinds of movements, but it's also a fact that they're a reflection of these societies, that they are organic to these societies rather than simply Iranian agents, and that given that reality, what if it were to happen in the West? Well, after the Madrid bombings, after 7/7, after the Manchester Arena bombings, etc., this wasn't done in the West. So I think that's the complicating factor here.
Okay, but if I could put it back to you, it's that, I mean, I'm an Australian. I live on a massive island.
Yes.
So I have a certain degree of security that an Israeli living in a very small country.
Yes.
I mean, I often make a joke about Europeans when they talk about climate issues. It's like, well, no offense, your country would be a farm here. I don't mean that in a necessarily derogatory way. It's just you have to appreciate
Belgium,
scale.
French again.
Yeah, and that's that's right. But I mean, I don't mean that to be rude, but I mean, the Israelis live on a very tight margin of security. I'm not for something extreme. I think one of the big problems of the obvious participation of UN agents in the acts of Hamas over the last few decades has been that how you would hope to solve this would be the United Nations would conduct a fair plebiscite on Gaza's future with the local inhabitants. There would be parties contesting a real election for a post-Hamas existence. There would be sponsors. In the normal world, that is how you would do it. You would have almost a form of UN trusteeship. But you can't do that because the Israelis just don't trust the United Nations at all. I mean, certainly the Americans, even if Trump wasn't the president, I don't think the Americans would either. And so you just have all this bad blood. I concede your point. I've never taken the view that necessarily Iran owns everything about Hamas. So I'm personally a skeptic of how much Iran knew about October 7th. Mm. I've often wondered if the Iranians, because if you know something about the way, if I can put it this way, the Iranians do terrorism. And I mean that not in a pejorative way. I just mean that in the way of tradecraft.
Yes.
It's a very, October 7th isn't the norm of how the Iranians, particularly, I'm not saying the Iranians are good, but I'm just saying there are things that terrorists do that necessarily the Iranians don't do. So for instance, after September 11, you know, the Iranians condemned September 11. They absolutely condemned it as un-Islamic. You know, there was just something very, very, just barbaric about it that offended, I guess, the Shia mind in a way that I don't think for, say, Salafist Takfiris, you have that same problem.
Yes.
I was in I hate going back to my past experiences, but in Iraq, you know, Al-Qaeda in Iraq was well known, for instance, to use mentally disabled or people with disabilities as unconscious suicide bombers. And they literally would send them into marketplaces and they would detonate them remotely. And the person carrying had no idea the backpack they were carrying stated idea. I mean, the sort of just brutal way of doing things. Very much, the Iranians had much more, I guess, a different kind of tradecraft, if I can put it that way. So I've always been something of a skeptic of what Iran really knew about October 7th, because I just can't help thinking that the Iranians would have said, don't do this, this is just dumb, this is stupid. But, you know, the way we do things is we do it through mass irritation. Don't forget, I've always said this, Will, in 2006, because I was in the Middle East in 2006, when they launched the Hezbollah against Israel, yes, the Israelis took some punches, but the Israelis smashed Hezbollah. I mean, they absolutely smashed Hezbollah to the point where Hezbollah took such a beating, they really didn't recover for a number of years. And certainly, in my understanding is in Lebanon itself, the beating that Hezbollah took, which affected the civilian populations in Lebanon, was something also that was held against Lebanon as well. Sorry, it was held against Hezbollah as well. So I guess I just have always been something of a skeptic of what Iran did. Now, what Iran did after October 7th was dumb in saying, oh, well, these are our sort of axis of resistance in the region. We have to support them. Instead of taking, I think, the more sober-minded view that a proper empire would take, and that is the dog wags the tail doesn't wag the dog, and we're going to let you take a beating here so that you learn a lesson, and which is what Iran didn't do. And so the Iranians, in a sense, have only got themselves to blame in that regard. But I've found, like, the idea of what do you do with Gaza post all this is I mean, you're not going to turn it into Dubai on the Mediterranean. You're going to have to find some way that's realistic to sort this. And I just think the idea of expelling or relocating the population is obviously unfeasible. I mean, it's unfeasible. Also, Egypt are not going to take the Palestinians.
They're not going to take them. My growing concern, Gray, is that the Israelis don't see any limits on their military power, and don't seem to have a sense of restraint in this cabinet under this leadership. So if you looked at 67 Israel, they were shocked at the territory that they recovered, that they captured. And they thought, well, maybe we should give some of it back and in exchange for peace. That never happened. It couldn't work, et cetera, et cetera. Fair enough. The voices who would think this way no longer exist in Israel. The Levi Eshkols who could think in this particular way and who could see, hold on, are we overextending ourselves? There must be some sort of shared legitimacy, no longer exist in Israel. And the refrain that the Israelis have kept on repeating was that the Arabs only understand force, we must always use force. And it seems to me that, in fact, this is in a way flipped, and that the Israelis only understand the use of force now. So the attempts to break the West Bank, the attempts to break the camps in the West Bank and to completely eliminate any kind of capability in the West Bank, on the one side, it's understandable. On the other side, it guarantees the Hamasification of the West Bank. The idea that the population would be expelled, well, the only way to do it is to go after to force open that border and see how the Egyptians retaliate, and militarily they can't do anything. And that's becoming a risk that's acceptable. So there's a big panic among people in the Middle East who I speak to that Egypt is next, and I tend to share that view, that the Israelis have lost the sense that we need to maintain a level of stability, and they are more on the side that says we will use as much force as it takes to build Fortress Israel.
Okay, so I can understand what you're saying. I think one of two things I would say in response is, and this is not to dispute anything that you've just said, is that after what Israel suffered, and the fact they've still got hostages that are being kept now, we're almost in July, I think the Israeli view would be, as long as you're holding our hostage, we're bringing the hammer down. And until we get everyone back, the hammer keeps falling. I think that would be the Israeli view. In respect to the West Bank, if that is correct, and I will defer to your knowledge here, that would be, I think, a big mistake, because you need to be able to distinguish sort of mortal threats from irritants. And insofar as the West Bank has been curious by what it has not done since October 7th, I mean... I think that that's a mistake.
Yeah.
I do think the one thing that, as going back to my civilizational PowerPoint, I think the one thing with the Israelis is that, I grew up in Sydney, and I mostly grew up in a Jewish part of Sydney in the eastern suburbs. So the eastern suburbs, I won't give you a long disquisition on the geography of Sydney, but it's an interesting city full of people from everywhere.
Yes.
So I grew up in the eastern suburbs. It's a very nice, it's a very affluent part of Sydney, but it's also historically, it's a very Jewish area. And I remember a colleague of mine saying about exactly what you're talking about the difference in Israeli politics. And he just said, everyone is Begin now. Everyone's Menachem Begin now. You know, Menachem Begin, who said, I am a Jew. I do not come to you on my knees. I come to you, you will respect us, kind of thing. And I have to be honest, I think it's just unreal not to understand among the not just Israelis, but the Jewish diaspora over the world, just how much what happened has affected them. And I think it would have been completely different if Hamas had attacked, say, like Israeli outposts or checkpoints, say like Hezbollah do, and they duck soldiers and they hold them in the sort of way that people are held there, etc. That might be one thing. But they went after women, they went after girls, just barbaric. And when you see that,
without doubt.
I'm just saying the primal response of people is, sorry, this is gloves come off. You've crossed the civilizational red line.
Yes.
And I just think that is something that I think it's unreal to sort of not understand. Now, it's not to excuse that. I mean, like after September 11, there were terrible things done in the aftermath of that were justified by, these people fled planes into buildings. Therefore, they've got where they're coming. But I'm just saying, I don't think there's going to be any kind of sensible restraint on what anyone is doing until all the hostages are back. And I think from the Israelis' perspective,
the issue with the hostages has been that Hamas's conditions for releasing them went from "we want hundreds of prisoners in exchange for each hostage" to "okay, so long as we get a full guarantee to end the war and some guarantees about reconstruction and aid," which sort of implicitly guarantee Hamas's survival. So the issue with the hostages now isn't that Hamas is still keeping them, it's that the Israelis reject the possibility of Hamas continuing in existence. The problem with that mindset, as far as I can see it, is that Hamas is unfortunately, a genuine expression of what the Palestinians want now. It wasn't always what the Palestinians wanted, but it is now, and that removing them is practically impossible. So the way that this conflict has played out, I mean, I think it was Hilaire Belloc that said something about the anger emanating from a crisis not making you fundamentally change your strategy and thinking as a precondition for being able to exercise wise policy. I wish I remember how he said it, because it would have sounded a lot better, but that's the best that I can do with it. And it seems to me that here, strategically, the Israelis have put themselves in a particular bind where they have the military power to do whatever they want, including do things like strike Iran. But the consequences of that are going to be a deeper hostility in the Muslim world than already existed. And I grew up in Jordan, where being called a Jew was the worst thing that you could be called. So this is starting from a high bar, and yet it's getting considerably worse. And the empowerment of Turkey, which is going to be considerably more competent than Iran by its very nature and its military tradition, and because, as the Arabs like to say, the Sunnah are for government and the Shia are for flagellation. The Shia can't rule well, the Sunnis can. And they have a more capable and impressive military history. So while accepting what you're saying on the emotions associated with it, it just seems to me, from a Western perspective, and I'm not a Westerner, but this is the Western mood, morally unacceptable to mass expel the Palestinians, who can't be compared to sort of Aborigines or to American tribes, because this is an advanced Islamic civilization, not a people living in prehistory. And the second one being a Sunni world that is more confident in its endless hostility to Israel, and that has a more effective leader in Turkey.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpoints. TC.